Our guest on Profile is Professor George List, Professor Emeritus of Folklore and Ethnomusicology. He was at IU for 20 years, retired for 30. While at IU, he not only taught but was director of the Archive of Traditional Music and Archive of Recordings, and was the founder of the teaching program in ethnomusicology. Before coming to IU, Professor List had a rather wide experience in the field of music, not only as a teacher, but as a performer, conductor, and composer. We'll touch upon as many of these activities as we can as we go. I'm George Walker. Professor List, you were born in the United States, but it wasn't quite the United States. Tell us a little bit about your birth and your family.
Well, I was born in Tucson, Arizona. Well, it was actually called the Territory of Arizona then. I was born in February 9th, 1911, and Arizona did not become the 48th state in the Union until February 14th, 1912. My father emigrated to the United States from Russia at the age of 15, had no education in this country, made a living as a hatter in Tucson, cleaning and blocking hats by hand. He had no education in the United States, but in Russia he was well-trained in Judaism and in Hebrew, and therefore he was the lay rabbi of Temple Emmanuel in Tucson. My mother was born in New York State of immigrant parents. She was the oldest of 11 children. She left school after the 8th grade in order to take care of her siblings. I'm the youngest of 3 children. My older brother was 14 years my senior. My brother was in business. My sister was a journalist and writer. Mm-hmm. She put out 2 books for high school use, and the last thing she did, as I remember it, was to write articles about chefs in big hotels and the food. She graduated from Columbia University, a degree in journalism in New York City, and worked on the Bronx Home News. Then after she married, she only had when I arrived to visit them in New York City in 1928, she had a children's column in the Jewish Daily Forward in the English section, which appeared only on Sundays. It was called The Roundabout.
Do you remember any details about that children's column?
Yes. It came out on Sunday, and one week she was tearing her hair because she had no copy. So I sat down and wrote a children's poem long enough to fill a whole column, imitating A.A. Milne, who, of course, everybody knows as Christopher Robin and Winnie the Pooh.
Your first instrument was flute.
And, yes.
I gather that you got a few lessons, but then pretty much had to take off on your own.
Yes, I had 6 lessons from the first flutist in the high school orchestra, and I bought a manual, and after that I taught myself as best I could.
At times you've described yourself as a square peg in a world of round holes. It appears that might have even been true in high school because you got out of there at age 15.
Well, if you want to call that a square peg in a round hole, yes. I was the youngest member of a class of 155 and 10th in scholarship. I would have done better in scholarship, but at the age of 13, I began to be interested more in girls than schoolwork.
You mentioned coming to New York in 1928 and that your sister was a Columbia graduate.
Yes.
Were you going to go to follow in her footsteps at Columbia?
Well, I had hoped to. I wanted to go to Columbia University and study music there. And I checked with the high school advisor when I was 13, showed him what courses I had taken and what courses I intended to take, and asked him if I would have the proper credits to enter Columbia University and come back. I came back the next week, and he said I had. Of course, when I got to Columbia University, I had 9 out of the required 15, couldn't get in. I don't know why he lied to me, but he did.
Where'd you go to school?
I couldn't get into any college university in New York City because I had only 9 out of the required 15 credits. So I registered at the Institute of Musical Art, a very well-known conservatory where all they demanded was a high school diploma. And, of course, I studied the flute there.
While you were studying there, how did you support yourself?
Well, while I was, for the first 5 years, until I got my diploma, my father sent me a certain amount of money. Remember, this was back in the 20s, and money value was somewhat different. He started out by sending me $50 a month, and then the Depression arrived, and he sent me $40. My room rent was $30. I sent out my laundry, and I earned the rest as a typist. I did inventory for the Quartermaster Corps out in Brooklyn and discovered the Army never throws anything away. There was one shoe size 14, 4E.
This 14E shoe you mentioned.
What about it? It was in the inventory. I had to type it into the inventory.
There were a lot of them?
No, the only thing I remember that I had only one shoe.
So they were looking for a one-legged person who took 14E?
Something like that.
I see.
And then I worked as a teletype operator for the Pennsylvania Railroad. And at the same time, I worked at night typing for an actuary. So I was able to save enough money to pay my tuition at the Institute of Musical Art, which was $200 a year. And I also registered for an extension course at Columbia University. I intended to do that every semester until I had the proper credits and I was going to transfer. But I ran out of money and I couldn't do that.
You got a diploma in flute, and this was at a time, though, when most of the musicians in the New York area were pretty much unemployed.
That's correct. The Vitaphone came in before the Depression. Most of the large cinemas in New York City before the Vitaphone came in had orchestras, and all those musicians were out of work. When I graduated in 1933, the unemployment rate in general was 20.7, and the Musicians Union, the local 802 in New York City, estimated that 80% of musicians were out of work. As far as I know, no orchestra musician who graduated along with me got a job that year that he could live on.
At a certain point, you actually got a grant to establish a music school for boys and girls.
Yes. That was from the Juilliard School of Music.
Tell us a little bit about that. Where did the funding come from, and who were your students?
Well, the funding came in a rather unusual way. When I graduated, my father stopped sending me any funds. So that summer, I worked as a music counselor in the camp in New Jersey. And then I got a position at the Madison Square Boys Club, which was on the east side in mid-Manhattan, basically to keep boys off the street so they wouldn't cause trouble. And I got room and board there for doing recreational work with the boys and teaching them old songs like East Side, West Side. And I organized a small ensemble. I found some kids that could play violin and piano, and I arranged to give a little concert. Well, I was fairly well known around school. I'd been editor of the school magazine and some other things, and so I invited the assistant dean to come to the concert, and he came. A few days later, I got a check for $500 in the mail from the Juilliard Foundation to help me in my teaching of music in that poor area. So I used that to start a little music school, and I insisted that we'd have girls as well as boys, and the head of the boys' club agreed. I used their facilities. And the other teachers were students or former students of the Juilliard.
That sounds like one of the more successful concerts of that particular period.
Yes, it was. Later, we gave two concerts at the Juilliard School of Music with the children. The first one among the things we performed was a children's play with music by Paul Hindemith. And the dean of the school was so taken with the thing that he paid for the kids to to have taxis to get home in. And I doubt very much if I'm 120th Street down to 30th Street. And I don't think those children were ever in a taxi before, and maybe they'll never be in a taxi again. But anyhow, they were running downtown singing hymns at the top of their lungs, which I thought was a rather unique experience.
Around this time, you meet a woman who becomes pretty important in your life.
Yes.
How did you meet Eve?
Well, when I graduated, we had a class show. And as part of the class show, I had written a gigue for flute, clarinet, and bassoon for my last theory assignment. And in it, I illustrated all the techniques of traditional counterpoint. In other words, I had three voices which would make good counterpoint no matter what combination you put them in, 1-2-3 or 3-2-1 or what have you. I had inversion, where melodies and counterpoints were played upside down instead of the right side up. I had them backwards and faster and slower. And I decided to choreograph the work. And the dances, what we did in the dance, imitated exactly what the music did. I danced the bassoon part, and I got two girls to dance the flute and clarinet part. I did the choreography myself. When we got to a dot half note, we thrust our behinds at the audience. And we did dance through once, and then I explained how it was done with help of the players, and we did over again. And Dean Hudson was so taken with it, he wanted us to perform it at the Cosmopolitan Club, but then decided we couldn't because they didn't allow women in the place.
Our guest on Profiles is Professor Emeritus of Folklore and Musicology, George List. I'm sorry that we don't have a recording, or even better, a film, of that graduation recital, but we'll have to settle for just a taste of a later work, just a snippet from the third movement of his string quartet.
I wrote movements of string quartet over time. It wasn't all written one time. This slow mood was actually written in the Christmas period of 1948, 3 months after my son Michael was born. And the performance is by the Berkshire String Quartet, which was the faculty string quartet at IU in those days.
Berkshire String Quartet playing just a taste of Professor George List's later string quartet. He continues with the story of his Juilliard graduation recital.
Well, apparently there was someone in that audience who was going to become my wife. I didn't know it at the time, obviously. And the next year, when I was taking graduate work, I worked as a busboy. And as I was doing my work, I heard a feminine voice humming a tune that anybody who was in this left-wing movement, which I was, would recognize. It's called Pie in the Sky. It's gone into folklore now. People talk about Pie in the Sky without knowing where it came from. It actually was a Protestant hymn called In the Sweet By and By, and a man named Joe Hill, who was one of the members of an old union we had early in the United States called the International Workers' Order, the IWW, wrote the words to it. If you want the words, it goes like this. Long-haired preachers come out every night, and they tell you what's wrong and what's right. If you ask them for something to eat, they will answer and answer in something that is so sweet. You will eat by and by in that glorious land above the sky. Work and pray, live on hay. You'll eat pie in the sky by and by. She hummed that tune. So I naturally went to see who hummed it. And it turned out a very attractive young lady. So I sat down and talked with her. And when I had it more time free, I'd come talk with her more. And I eventually got her telephone number. And that's how it started.
We're talking with Professor Emeritus George List. This is about 1934. And at this point, you're finishing up in some of your classes, and you're playing as a flutist in the Federal Music Project. You're also doing some conducting and teaching for the International Works Order. Taking some of your classes at the school that you'd come to town to go to in 1928, Columbia.
Yes, my salary to work at that music school at the Boys Club was paid for by the Federal Music Project, WPA. I was on that. That's called work relief. I was on that for 5 years. And the music school lasted for 3. After that, for 2 years, I played flute on the project. I played in the chamber music, theater orchestra, symphony orchestra. Then I decided I better get myself a degree so I can find a regular job. So I entered Teachers College at Columbia University in order to help pay my way through there. I had 5 children's ensembles through this International Workers' Order, which was a fraternal organization. Mostly they had different groups of ethnics in there. Almost all the older people were immigrants, and it was their children that I worked with. So I had 2 Jewish bands, a Hungarian band, a Croatian tambourist orchestra, and a Lithuanian mandolin orchestra.
Later you go on to a distinguished career as an ethnomusicologist. It almost sounds as if you were doing ethnomusicology at this point.
Well, I didn't know anything about ethnomusicology at that point.
But that's quite a spectrum of Eastern Europe.
Yes, it is.
Our guest on Profile is George List, Professor Emeritus of Folklore and Ethnomusicology. You graduated and you were teaching in the public schools first as a sub, then really just driving the wheels off a car, driving from school to school to do your teaching.
Well, that's the way it happened. I had a substitute position for a month in the New York City public schools, teaching sophomores in a automobile trade school of high school. And then in January 1942, I was employed to teach in a grade school in Long Island 2 days a week. I had orchestras in a small school and a band in a large school. And then the next year they gave me 3 days, and then I had 2 days in Spring Valley, New York, which is about 75 miles distant. I lived in Lower Manhattan. So I got up at 6, went out to eat breakfast. I wouldn't wake my wife, drove through Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, until I got to Elmont, Long Island, and I did 3 days out there. And the other 2 days I had the same routine in the morning, only I drove 25 or 30 miles up the Hudson, up New York City, got the Washington Bridge across to Jersey, and then all the way up to where it becomes New York again, Spring Valley, and I taught there 2 days a week. So I had a full schedule.
Indeed.
Well, after my year of divided loyalty between these 2 grade school systems, I taught for a year in a large high school out on Long Island, 4,000 students in that school. I had a band of 75 adolescent boys, which is more than I bargained for. Then I decided I'd better teach college. I would not have any discipline problems, probably. And I probably would teach a higher class of music. So I went back to Columbia University and finished my master's degree in the middle of the year. And then, having nothing else to do, I drove 12 hours towards an ED, Doctor in Education degree. And then the only position I could find to teach in college was at Colorado College in Colorado Springs. That was a duration position. The high school job was a duration position, and the string ballet was a duration position. That means that the position was being held for whoever had it before you took it. In other words, you were taking a position that somebody had held who was now in the military service, and when they returned, they got the job back, and you lost it.
While you were at Colorado College, there was the celebration of VJ Day. What was that like?
There is a place just outside of Colorado Springs called the Garden of the Gods. There are very large stones there of all kinds of different colors. We were out there, a whole crowd of us, and I might add we had some liquor, celebrating the VJ Day. I got on top of a rather large rock and tried to get in telepathic communication with my wife in New York City. She didn't go with me. She stayed in New York City because she had a career going there. So I went to Colorado by myself. I was there by myself for 6 months before she finally came. So that telepathic communication wasn't very successful, I'm afraid.
But it was inspirited.
Oh, yes. I didn't drink. I was the only one who didn't drink because I was doing the driving.
I see. But you were high on life?
I would say so, yes.
We're talking with George List, Professor Emeritus of Folklore and Ethnomusicology. In 1946, you went to Ohio and became an assistant professor of music at
Miami University.
Miami University.
Yeah. It's a state university. I basically taught music theory, harmony, counterpoint, ear training, and I taught flute, and I conducted a very good a cappella chorus, and I gave a chorus in contemporary music. In the summer, I taught bandstration and music appreciation, mostly to public school teachers. And my wife was also on the faculty there teaching voice and piano, and every year we gave a joint recital, flute and piano.
So here, beginning in 1946, you finally have a full-time position.
And a permanent one.
Teaching at the college level.
Right.
You mentioned earlier that you had been involved in left-wing causes, that part of the pickup you'd had on Eve was when she was kind of humming a song that was popular in the workers' movement, and that you'd actually also taught for
a left-wing organization, yeah, in National Workers' Order.
And I gather that there were some things about not necessarily the school but the community of Oxford, Ohio, that didn't seem to be quite right to you.
Well, I wasn't the only one who felt that way. We had a committee we formed of mostly professors from the university, including my wife and myself, and the minister of the Episcopalian Church. Oxford was a very small community of 2,500, yet they had their own swimming pool. Now, the land had been given to them by a local golf club on a restrictive covenant, which indicated that blacks could not swim in the pool. One quarter of the population were blacks. Oxford had been on the railroad to help blacks escape from the South. They worked mostly as janitors. Well, the young blacks were quite upset that they couldn't swim in that pool, and we all thought that was wrong. And the Supreme Court had already outlawed a restrictive covenant, which is what they had to keep the blacks out, plus the fact that the state of Ohio had passed two laws against discrimination in public places back in the 1870s or 80s. So we decided to go to court and force the integration of the pool. I took the responsibility of making the test case. I arranged to have a white couple, a black couple, and a white couple, in that order, apply for admission. And, of course, the whites were allowed in, not the blacks, and we had six witnesses. as evidence that the pool was segregated. So I went to court, and the judge had no recourse but to declare the pool to be integrated because the law was on our side. But he sent a notice to the paper that we were a bunch of troublemakers and meddlers. He apparently did, and a number of people in town remonstrated with us that we hadn't done something they liked particularly. Two young men who were the son of the man who owned the garage where I had my car repaired said they would never swim in that pool again. They'd go for a drive all the way down to Cincinnati, 35 miles away, so they could swim in a segregated pool. So I changed garages.
They changed pools, you changed garages.
That's right.
Our guest on Profile is George List, Professor Emeritus of Folklore and Ethnomusicology. We do need to mention that early on it had become apparent that you actually were losing your sight and that this was going to be a problem. And in 1950, you actually had an operation.
On both eyes, yes. That was while I was at Miami University. I decided to work on a doctor's degree. I went to IU 1950-1951. It was only about a few months before that I realized I had glaucoma, and I had the operation 2 weeks before I started my graduate work. And the first semester was a bit difficult. I had to do a good deal of resting in my room. It was a difficult year because I came home every weekend by bus. I had to go downtown, take the Greyhound up to Annapolis, change across to Richmond. My wife picked me up at Richmond and took me 20 miles to Miami. Saturday morning, I taught flute, and I visited with my family. My son then was two, I believe. And then every Sunday evening, I'd bust all the way back again. So that was that year.
Wow. You continued to work on a degree at IU and eventually decided that you would leave Miami of Ohio. And I'm very curious about something. Dean Sutherland wrote a note that you have kept, and he said that you were an independent soul who cares more about students than administrators, had great integrity, a restless mind, and an interest in educational problems. And then he goes on to say, although I disagree with many opinions of his, he has a broad and deep awareness of music as one of the humane literatures and its relationship to others and to the society. How could one disagree with one thinking that music is part of the humane literature and its relationship to others in society?
Well, let's say I have a radical past. Like quite a number of other young idealists in the early 30s, this country was in one, if I may use the term, hell of a mess when it came economically. And we came to the conclusion that the only real solution was socialism. So we joined the Communist Party. I was a member for 2 years, so was my wife. After 2 years, we couldn't stomach the dogmatism of the leaders, and we dropped out. I don't suppose we still believe in socialism as such, but we were always on the aggressive end of everything, you might, if you want to call it that. I remember giving a talk at Miami University about the relationship between society and music. And with that background, what I would say wouldn't fit exactly within the limits of a man who was dean of a school. He was a very good person, but he wouldn't agree with me on some of the things I said. Does that answer your question?
I think. In 52-53, you got a Ford Foundation fellowship that allowed you to finally stop busing up to Indianapolis and then over to Richmond and having Eve pick you up. You were able to move the family to Bloomington while you finished up your degree work for a PhD.
Yes.
At this time, you actually took a couple of classes that later turned out to be perhaps more important in your career than you thought they would be.
Well, let me give you a bit of background on that. I don't know exactly how it happened, But we had decided to offer a joint course at Miami University with a folklorist from the English department, with an anthropologist from the anthropology department, and with me. And we were going to try to integrate folklore, anthropology, and music as best we could. Well, I needed some information. I needed some more background than I had. I was a member of the American Musicological Society, as was the dean, and they were having a meeting at Indiana University. At Indiana University at the time had a faculty member named George Herzog, who was the most prominent person in the country in the, what they then called comparative musicology, which later became ethnomusicology. So we went over there to that meeting. The American Musicological Society had a meeting there, and the dean arranged for me to have a luncheon with George Herzog, and he gave me a great deal of material in the way of bibliography and what have you for that course. That's when I first met George Herzog. One reason I went to Indiana University, well, the main reason was convenient. I could get there in 3 hours and back. But the other reason was that he offered a course in folk music and a course in primitive music. I took the course in folk music with him in 1950-51.
You graduate with a PhD in music theory, minors in composition and education in 1954. And here comes one of the themes, I think, of this part of your life, and that's in some ways being overqualified and in other ways being not quite the peg that people wanted to put in a round hole. I noticed that one of the applications you made was for a job in Alabama, and they described you as too much a cosmopolitan Yankee.
Yes.
Had you ever been a Yankee?
Not to my knowledge.
That's quite a label to put on a person, don't you think?
Well, they wanted a Southerner, and they hired a Southerner.
So at 45 years of age in 1956, you were looking for a variety of positions.
I basically looked for them in 54 and couldn't find them. And I found this little job at IU, which I took. And this thing in Alabama came the next year. In 55, and then I decided I couldn't find a position in music anymore.
So you decided that you would attempt to make something of the position working with the archives at IU?
That's correct.
In 57, you have your first publication in the field of folklore and folk music. You actually become a collector. At what point do you do that, and where did you collect?
Well, in 1955, I spent an afternoon recording the children of the neighborhood in Bloomington, what they knew in the way of children's songs. That, I suppose, was my first collection. Then my brother lived in Holbrook, Arizona, and he was 80 miles away from the Hopi Indian Reservation. And I felt that was somewhat of an in. The university had something called the Research Committee. They received funds from the IU Foundation, and I got some money from them, and I went out to Arizona with my family, and we spent a good deal of time on the Hopi Indian Reservation, and I recorded music of the Hopi Indians that summer, 1960.
Is that the recording that we have?
That's correct. Music of the Hopi Indians.
So that was in 1960. During the years between 1956 and 1960, you were doing some publications. You also were starting to teach a variety of courses, sometimes paid and sometimes out of the goodness of your heart.
Yes.
And concern, I think, for students and the field.
Well, I rather like to teach.
What courses were you teaching?
Well, when I first came, Herzog was on leave, and there was an enrollment for his course in folk music. Since I'd had the course with him, I managed to talk to the head of the anthropology department to have me teach it. So I taught a course in folk music, and I did it as a lecturer in folk music. And then there are a number of graduate students, mostly in folklore and some in anthropology, who came to me and wanted me to teach a course in the transcription of folk music. And I couldn't because I wasn't a member of the faculty. And they finally prevailed after 3 years. Vice President Ashton, who was my superior basically, had talked to the dean of the music school and given me the title of lecturer in music. And so I started teaching a course in fieldwork and transcription of folk music for these students. I taught it for 4 years without any pay, 2 semesters, rather enjoyed myself. And one of those students eventually became head of archive of music, of folk music at the Library of Congress. Another one became an editor at the Illinois Press. Another one eventually taught anthropology at University of California in Berkeley. So it wasn't a waste of time, really.
You certainly were contributing to the field.
Yes.
At the same time, you were doing some publications and even started a journal.
Yes. I should add that when Herzog was retired, I again taught his folk music course, this time for the anthropology department. I started a little journal called The Folklore and Folk Music Archivists, and we had articles on all the archives of folklore and folk music around the world, and articles on the problems of archiving. Yeah, I wrote a couple articles on the history of the cylinder phonograph and how they were produced. It got around.
At this point, you have a degree in music with a number of credits in education. At the same time, you're working in the folklore area, and you're also kind of working in the anthropology area and perhaps even in the ethnomusicology area with a lot of skills that you yourself had built up, but it was a little difficult to find a department that was willing to say, this is the kind of polymath that we could use and we want to have associated with our particular department.
Well, the problem is partly in the way a university is organized. The music school wasn't interested in having an ethnomusicologist. The anthropology department, although they were happy to employ me to teach a course, weren't going to employ me because I didn't have a PhD in anthropology. Most of my students came from folklore. Unfortunately, folklore was not a department. It was a program. Now, a program can offer degrees, but it has no faculty. Its faculty is taken from everybody else's faculty. Eventually, folklore became a department, and I was eventually employed there. That's how I became a faculty member.
And during this time, one thing that had been developing was the IU archives, and you're becoming a leading field in the field of archiving and also in the field of teaching people that archives weren't simply someplace where you put things. They were actually tools.
Yes. Well, Herzog had started this archive at Columbia University, and when he came here, it was brought here with him. He always used it as his own personal research tool and had a couple of graduate students once in a while, but nobody else ever had made any use of it. What I basically did was to turn it into a public archive. I became quite known as an archivist in 59. I gave a talk on archiving for the Folklore Society in Texas at University of Austin. In 60, I went to Vienna and gave a talk with international Conference of Directors of Linguistic Archives in 1960. I was also at the University of California in Los Angeles giving a talk. So I got around in that respect.
Yes, indeed. Our guest on Profile is George List, Professor Emeritus of Folklore and Ethnomusicology. Looking here at another one of the recordings that you made, two young men from Colombia.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that recording and how you came to do that.
Well, the archives became a little too successful. And although I had a full-time secretary and four graduate assistants, I had no professional help. The university would not appoint another person to help me. So I got myself a Fulbright and went away for a year. And they had to employ somebody as an assistant to me. And I went to Columbia, South America on a Fulbright, both a research and a teaching Fulbright. I did some lecturing at the university. Of course, this is all done in Spanish. I worked mostly in the Caribbean coastal region because I met and made friends with two educated Colombians who were from that area and were willing to go in the field and help me. I could manage standard Spanish, but in the countryside, they spoke a dialect of Spanish, and it was a little difficult to figure it out without somebody to help you. This recording is of a safra, which is a work song. They worked out in the fields with these big knives called machetes, either cutting down weeds or cutting down their crops. And they would sing while they did this, usually two or more men singing, answering each other. They sing in a mixture of shouting and singing. And these two young men, Cecilio and Serafino, are talking about their sister who's disappeared and they don't know what's happened to her and they're going to go look for her.
En los campos de Matulla, Moreno, fue que se perdió Carmela. Hombre, 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 caramba, muchacho, no mames bulla, Moreno, yo creo que no se muera. Lo, 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 rogando que no se muera. Jesús sabía de Carmen bonita. Hombre, ay, 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 caramba, Dios mío. Hombre, 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 me encuentro como llorate, Moreno. Hombre, Dios mío, la muerte Carmela Pérez. Es todo bien, Carmen, Morenito, Carmela Pérez. Moreno mío, caramba, lo encuentro como llorate. Ay, 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 mamá. Hola.
A safra, which is a work song.
In 1965, tenure, you'd been teaching at IU and working with the archives for more than 10 years, and at this point got tenure. You go on at this point to found a program in ethnomusicology.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Inter-American program?
Well, I went off on this Fulbright. I spent 15 months in South America. And when I came back, I was appointed as associate professor of folklore while I was away. And when I came back, I started teaching in the folklore department, it was then called. Well, they call it the Folklore Institute, but it functioned as a department. Now, in those days, the Ford Foundation was very much interested in international affairs, and they were offering universities large sums of money for African studies, Asian studies, Latin American studies. And the university received a grant of several million dollars from the Ford Foundation for Latin American Studies. I had just been doing work in Latin America, and I was already publishing about this material. So some of the money was made available to me. and I used it to start a teaching program, which was in folklore, which I called the Inter-American Program in Ethnomusicology. And, of course, we had to get the permission of the graduate school, but we were offering the M.A. and the Ph.D. in folklore with an emphasis in ethnomusicology, and they always did their thesis or their dissertation on in the field of ethnomusicology, usually by going out in the field and collecting and recording and using that as the basis for the dissertation. There was another man on campus who taught ethnomusicology in the anthropology department, Merriam. He was an Africanist. He'd taken the place of Herzog. And I brought, for the first 3 years, I brought in professors from Latin America to teach. I had the first one, we had people from Venezuela, the second time from Brazil, and the third time from Chile. And the fourth year, I managed to employ a young man, Charles Bourlet, who got his Ph.D. in ethnomusicology in Tulane, and had lived in Mexico for years and worked with the Mexican Indians. And I also had him start a general course in world music open to undergraduates. And he did very well. We had as many as 400 students in that class at one time, and with four graduate assistants to help him.
Wow.
It was a very popular course. Of course, I taught basically seminars, and, well, every year I taught a course in the transcription analysis of traditional music. I taught a course in folk music and Western civilization, and I taught seminars in Latin American ethnomusicology, in field work and that sort of thing.
At your retirement in 1976, I think one of your students said that that sometimes your critiques of a transcription could run almost as long as the transcription.
Yes. That was Abraham Castris, who drops in once in a while and takes me out to dinner. He does pretty well. He doesn't teach for an institution. He does lectures on world music at public schools, basically.
I think he claimed that he'd given you 21 pages and you gave him 22.
No, it was 22 and 22.
It was even?
Even Stephen, yes. The story that he told at my retirement party was that he was awakened early one morning by my secretary, who said he had immediately come to my office. And when he came to my office, I pointed to his transcription. I pounded my head on my fist on the table and pointed at it and said, "That I is not dotted." That's his story. It's strictly apocryphal, but that's all right. I did have a penchant for a detail.
Our guest on Profile is Professor Emeritus of Folklore and Ethnomusicology George List. One of the features of his retirement celebration was a performance of his own memoir for flute and piano from 1951. Thank you. The memoir for flute and piano from 1951 by our guest on Profile, Professor Emeritus of Folklore and Ethnomusicology, George List. In 1976, you retire with really proud tributes, the continued development of the ethno program in the archives, and from students who'd gone on to success. In 1977, you lose your ability to read, but you've produced an incredible amount of work between 1977 and when we're talking now, 30 years later.
Yes. Well, I just didn't want to stop. Should I?
I'm not going to say yes.
Well, I had been working for many years on a book on the music in one village in Colombia, and it was 850 pages of manuscript, and nobody would publish it. So I finally, I didn't finish it until just before I lost my sight. I actually retired a year early in order to finish it. And the IU Press said they would publish it if I would reduce it in size to a maximum of 640 pages and provide it to them camera ready. In other words, I would have it typed on a electric typewriter to fit the page and have all the spaces open for the photographs and the 150 transcriptions, what have you. And they finally published it. It came out in 1983 at 637 pages, which is not bad. I only missed it by three. Nellie Rubel, the editor, was so excited at what I accomplished that she gave a donation to the Library for the Blind in Annapolis in my name. While I'm bragging, I might as well mention that in 2002, I received an inheritance of over $10,000 from a former student. He sang in a chorus for 2 years with me at my university, so I must have made an impression on him.
My goodness, and that was 40 years ago.
Yes, it was.
Indeed.
He became superintendent of schools in some place in Ohio, never married.
And he remembered you.
Yes.
We've been talking with Professor George List. Are there some things we should, a couple of other highlights perhaps from 83 to 2002? As I remember, there's another publication in there.
Yeah, two other publications in there of size.
Mm-hmm.
The Indiana Historical Society funded me to write a book on folk song in southern Indiana, which I called Singing About. That was 440 pages. That came out on my 80th year, 1991. And 2 years later, another book, this time on Hopi Indian songs, came out, American Philosophical Society, in 1993, my 82nd year. The last two articles I published in 1997, I published a long article on Hopi song for the and its context in the Journal of Society of Musicology. In 2002, I published an article on archiving folklore in the Folklore Historian, which is published in Indiana State University. So I haven't been completely lazy.
Our guest on Profile has been George List, Professor Emeritus of Folklore and Ethnomusicology. I'm George Walker. Thanks for listening.
The program you just heard was recorded in April of 2007. Emily McCord was our research assistant. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.